This Sounds Good on WKMS. It's our midday music and community conversation program. I am Tracy Ross. Kate Lochte has joined me in the studio, and on the phone we have Tori Merton McClure. She is president of Spalding University, and she was the first woman to ever make a solo row across the Atlantic Ocean. Tori, thanks so much for being on Sounds Good today.
Oh, my pleasure.
So I guess our audience just needs to know that you are Superwoman.
No.
Well, it sounds like that to me. Several degrees from prestigious colleges, not the least of which is the Master of Divinity from Harvard. Your comments about existentialism and Harvard Divinity School are most amusing. You encountered Hurricane Danielle in your first attempt to row across the Atlantic, and you were capsized several times and then pitch-poled, and then you decided to call for help. How come you waited so long?
Oh, I ended up writing a book about my journeys. It's called A Pearl in the Storm, and it was the book was required reading at the United States Coast Guard Academy 1 year, and I went up and had lunch with Admiral Burho, who was the superintendent of the academy at the time, and he said, "I read your book." I said, "Yes, sir," and I was a little frightened about what he might ask or say. He goes, "I'd have pushed the button a little sooner." And I said, "But sir, I was on the other side of the ocean. Someone might have gotten hurt." And he liked that answer because he liked the notion that I respected our Coast Guard enough to think that, yeah, they could have come and gotten me. But it really was too dangerous to ask for help. I chose to go on the North Atlantic in a rowboat, and I had to take responsibility for that act. And I didn't at the time know it was a hurricane. I just knew it was really, really bad. And because I'd lost communications 8 days from the start on that trip. So it'd been about 78 days that I'd been without contact. And so no one could say, "Hey, look out, there's a hurricane coming." And when the hurricane hit, the morning it arrived, the boat capsized 5 or 6 times. And I thought, you know what, I can't take this anymore. I'm going to go set off my distress beacon. And I went out on deck. Deliberately, I placed the distress beacon on the bow bulkhead on the front of the boat as far away from the cabin as I could, so I would really have to think about it. I'd have to get out of the cabin, tie into my safety tether, crawl across the deck to get the EPIRB. Now, it's really only about 8 feet away, but still, it's a huge distance in a roaring storm. In the time it took me to get out there, waves were washing over the boat. It was doing this really annoying submarine thing. When the boat goes so far under the surface of the water that your ears pop, it's a really bad sign. And I realized I couldn't ask someone else to come out there and get me. So I tied the distress beacon to my life vest. I went through 5 or 6 more capsizes that day with the distress beacon tied to my life vest, not setting it off with my other hand. 2 of my capsizes were end-over-end pitch poles. One capsize dislocated my shoulder. It wasn't actually a pitch pole that dislocated my shoulder, but one capsize dislocated my shoulder, and the next capsize put it back into place. And so it was
bad. Ouch. I'm sure our listeners are going, "Oh, my God." And you can actually see YouTubes of you in your cabin talking about this. It's just wild that you did this. And then you came back safe, and you started working with Muhammad Ali, and he told you that you'd better try it again.
My first real meeting with Muhammad was at dinner, and I'd been asked if I wanted to work for Muhammad Ali, and I said, "Yeah, I'd like to work for Muhammad Ali. That'd be pretty cool." And it was a dinner, and the table was sort of kind of a long bowling alley of a table, and I felt like a pedestrian there, and so I kind of held back and waited till all the important people sat down. And as it turned out, the only seat available at the table was directly across from Muhammad Ali, and I sat down, and he was staring at me, and I, you know, I've said before, you know, when Muhammad Ali stares at you as a way of removing the oxygen from the room, and I was like, what have I done? What's wrong? And he said, "Were there times out there you wondered, why am I here?" And I thought for a minute, and I said, "Muhammad, were there times in the boxing ring when you wondered, why am I here?" And he just started to laugh, and there was this incredible moment of recognition. I had been knocked on my butt and was sort of rolling around on the ground, and here was somebody who knew exactly where I was. And he pretty much reached down and picked me up. And it was a couple months later, he said, "Tori, you don't want to go through life as the woman who almost rode across the ocean." And so I went back, and ultimately I finished. But the second time I did go the easy way. I left the coast of Africa and went to the Caribbean, across the mid-Atlantic instead of trying to cross the North Atlantic. The North Atlantic has been crossed in a rowboat, but not by me.
So you only rowed about 3,000 miles alone?
Right. Well, actually, 6,000 if you count the first trip, but it's a long time to be alone. And now, as you know, I'm a university president, and folks say, what's the hardest part of your job? And I said, cocktail parties. And they think I'm kidding. I said, but if you can spend 3 months alone in a rowboat, you're an introvert. And so being a university president is almost punishment, but it's a great job, and I love doing it.
Well, you have brought Spalding to the point of being the first compassionate university. I don't completely understand what that means, but it sounds nice.
Yeah,
nice, not in the silly word nice, but just comforting.
Yeah, we don't fully understand what it means. And actually, yesterday I was kind of in a bad mood, and I said, we're not going to be a compassionate university anymore. It's too hard. Because I keep getting these letters going, you claim to be a compassionate university, but you're not paying enough attention to my group. And so I'm like, okay, I give up. We're not going to do it anymore. How it happened is there's this wonderful document called the Charter for Compassion, and it was drafted by the Dalai Lama, Desmond Tutu, and probably a dozen world leaders in the subject of religion and faith. The primary drafter was the author Karen Armstrong, who is a historian of religion. She's written about 22 books on the subject of religion and faith. And it's her premise, and I'm inclined to agree with it, that any version, any major world religion, any serious philosopher always voices some variation of the golden rule, the oldest version of which we're aware comes from Confucius, who said, whatever is hateful to you, you must refuse under any circumstances to do to another. It exists in Buddhism, it exists in Hinduism. Rabbi Hillel in Judaism has asked, I imagine by a recalcitrant teenager, but I don't know that for a fact. He's asked, if you can recite the whole of Torah while standing on one foot, I will convert to Judaism. So Hillel stands on one foot and says, do not do unto others what you would not have them do unto you. That is the whole of Torah. The rest is merely commentary. Go and learn it. And for me, in Christianity turns it to the positive. Islam picks up that version from Christianity. But for me, it's really that recognizing that it can't just be about me. It can't just be about my stuff. It's got to be about the broader community. And in the United States, we get so focused from time to time on competition and winning that we don't always keep the good of the whole in mind. And I really do think that from time to time we need to switch hats. And I'm an athlete. I'm competitive as they come. But if I am trying to beat somebody, it doesn't help me to figure out how we're alike. I have to figure out how we're different so I can exploit that difference and beat them into the dust. If I am thinking about it in a compassionate way, if I want to be compassionate towards someone, I have to figure out how we're the same and how I can support that sameness. And as I look at our students who choose to come to Spalding University have often been through something. Half our students are first generation. A lot of them are Pell eligible, meaning they come from economically challenged households. About a third are from underrepresented minorities. Students choose to come to Spalding because they want to learn how to make a difference. They want to go be teachers. They want to go be social workers. They want to go be psychologists or nurses. We've got a wonderful writing program. But it's really, they've been through something. And what makes you, I think, turn away from people in pain is not that you don't care. You turn away from people in pain because you don't know what to do. And education is how to solve that in my world. And honestly, I rowed across the ocean because I was tangled up in my own sense of helplessness. I grew up with a brother who's intellectually disabled, and I thought, man, if I could just climb one more mountain, I won't feel helpless. If I can get one more academic degree, I won't feel helpless anymore. If I can row across the ocean. So when I talk to teenagers, I say, you know, I rowed across the ocean because I was stupid. Most women don't need to row a boat across an ocean to figure out that love and friendship are good things. I did. I had to row a boat across the ocean to figure that out. So how smart am I?
Well, I'm sort of lost in deep respect for everything you're saying. And I want to tie in rapidly that you are coming to Paducah for the October 17th Partnership in Power, or Power in Partnership Breakfast of the Chamber of Commerce. And I understand that your coming here is partially about that experience of your brother being bullied and about your compassion for homeless people. Is that going to be the gist of your presentation here?
You know, I imagine I will tell, I've come to learn that people pretty much invite me to come talk to them because I took this rowboat alone across the ocean. They don't invite me because I'm the president of Spalding or other things. So I have learned at my peril that I better talk about rowboats a little bit. So I'll probably tell some rowboat stories, probably connect it a little bit, and then I'll open it up for questions and see where the audience wants to go, which is my favorite part of any presentation because I know what I'm going to say. And what's interesting is where does the audience want to go? And where can we go together? So I can't give you too much of a preview because I don't know where we're going to end up.
Then let me ask you this.
I hope it'll be fun.
I doubt it'll be fun. I can tell already. So you are a proponent of being a useful person. You've become an EMT so that, you know, both for rural and urban settings, so that you can help if you see somebody in trouble. You are active. You are an active adventurer. And yet there must be, because you're just a human being too, you must be afraid of something now, even though you've overcome all of those fears.
Yeah, cocktail parties, really. I'm not kidding. It's those unscripted social events where, you know, that awkward teenage side of me still lurks in the corner. And, you know, folks, when I say that, oh, I'm an introvert, they go, no, you're not an introvert. And it's like, okay, your dog or your cat has their tricks, and so do I. I've learned how to navigate in the world, but it doesn't necessarily come naturally to me. Which reminds me of, you know, I was able to spend a few days with the author Karen Armstrong, and she wrote A History of God. And she was giving me grief about this rowboat thing, and I said, wait a minute. You wrote A History of God. You don't get to pick on me for being audacious. And what was neat about her is this: she's incredibly intellectual, and if an extrovert is a 10 and an introvert is a 0, I'm about a 1. Karen Armstrong is about a minus 12. She understands compassion on a global scale, but loving her actual neighbor, probably not so much. Yeah.
Now, I listened to a little bit of what you were saying to a group of Engineers Without Borders relating to liberal arts education, and I found that so fascinating, that the idea of working with your hands and your brain at the same time to do good for people, what an interesting and hard concept to instill in education.
Yes, I don't actually remember what I said to the engineers, but I am a graduate of Smith College, and I served on the board of trustees at Smith when they decided to create a school of engineering. Now, Smith is still an all-women's school, and they wanted to address the fact that there's so few women in engineering, so they thought the way to do that was to open a school of engineering. Well, to hear some of the faculty talk, you would have thought we'd set the campus on fire, because, you know, we've abandoned the liberal arts. It's like, okay, well, what's more liberal about physics and less liberal about thermodynamics? It really has to do with the shallow sophistication that says if you use your hands, you are less than, and if you use your brain, you're better than. Well, now we've reached an era in human development where the computer can replace a lot of intellectual activity, and what we need is the nurse by the bedside who's going to give you the morphine after the radiologist in Mumbai has read your X-ray. So that head, hand, and heart are really going to be more valued in the coming decades, and I think we'll see that in some disciplines, like nursing has become more and more valued over time, And those people who can use their head and use their hands and have some sense of goodness or compassion are really going to be highly valued, because we can replace the lawyer and the accountant with a lot of stuff that's on the internet. I am a lawyer, so don't send me letters, hateful letters.
Tori Merton McClure, I'm glad you're on Earth and that you spoke with us on Sounds Good today.
Thank you.